Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
His State of the Union. But as President Bush touches down in Nashville, the first stop on his post-speech tour, the talk on at least one radio station there was of the Democrats this morning. Here's a sample from the Steve Gill Show on Supertalk 99.7 WTN in Nashville.
You know what, Steve? I didn't know diddly about John Kerry, but I've seen President Bush in office, and I think he's a jerk.
Gary in Charlotte is next up. Good morning, Gary. You're on WTN.
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you, man.
Good morning.
Hey, man, that last caller completely outraged me. Let's send her to Iraq and see how long it would take her to call George Bush and appreciate what he's doing for us.
Put her in a burqa, baby. Thanks,
that's
Gary.
Right,
737-9986.
That is just a sample of the Steve Gill Show on WTN in Nashville. And as we said in the rest of the morning's program, they were talking most about the Democrats, criticizing them largely. In last night's speech, President Bush extended an olive branch of sorts to Democrats, asking for a bipartisan commission on health care and a dialogue of respect. But today, critics of the Bush administration's war in Iraq and on terrorism are responding to his implication that they are isolationists, after the president said, if we leave the terrorists alone, they will not leave us alone. Here's Democratic strategist James Carville.
Name three Democrats that say we should leave the terrorists alone. I mean, I don't know of any Democrat that doesn't say that we want to fight terrorism.
Gail Chadwick covers Capitol Hill for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us now from Washington. Gail, first of all, did the president score points with his characterization of his critics as isolationist and defeatist?
Well, I think he certainly scored points with his own base, who already believed that, but it really did anger Democrats. I was speaking with Senator Carl Levin after the talk, who said that he just felt the president had set up a straw man and that it was, and then knocked it down, that there weren't any Democrats that didn't favor aggressively defending the country. And Democrats, I think, sense that that is the president's one remaining strength right now, that is strong on national security, and they don't want to be cartooned as weak on it.
Well, this previously oil-friendly administration also called for more alternative fuels, called to break Americans' addiction to oil, wandering into what had been Democratic territory. What else jumped out at you from last night?
I was very interested in the issues where there actually may be bipartisan support. For example, the Math and Science Initiative, which is 70,000 new teachers to lead AP classes, you know, 30,000 scientists, doubling the research in the physical sciences. That's something that even before the State of the Union, a number of Democrats, Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, not usually a Bush supporter, said, I really hope the president talks a lot about this. We can support him on it.
Well, it was okay.
Also interesting to see the splits on issues like immigration, when the president said that immigrants were essential to our economy. You know, some Republicans leaping to their feet and clapping, others sitting sullenly on their hands. There are issues that divide parties as well. Immigration is one of them.
Well, the polls are in. A CBS poll from last night showed that three-quarters of the people who were asked and who watched the speech said they approved of the proposals made by President Bush. But only a third who saw the speech and who were polled thought the president will be able to achieve the goals he mentioned. And I'm just, you know, looking forward to the midterm and his road trip in about the minute we have. How do you see this playing out?
Well, it was a speech of diminished expectations, and realistically so. There isn't money, with the war in Iraq ongoing, for broad new domestic initiatives. And that's the reality that he'll face both in the Congress and in trying to sell this program on the road. Anytime anyone asks him, how will you spend it? How will you pay for it?
In the few seconds we have, do you think the president will win back some of the Republican candidates looking for midterm elections who've been distancing themselves from the president?
His greatest support and greatest trophy for the last year was sitting right in front of him, Judge Samuel Alito. He can still play the courts and how important it is to transform the courts to be more conservative, and that he clearly has done.
Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, last night, President Bush also called on Congress to expand health savings accounts, which allow people to take money from wages before taxes and spend that money on health care. He also urged Americans to purchase their own low-premium, high-deductible insurance plans. It's called consumer-driven health reform. We want to spend some time on it. The idea is that people will spend their health care dollars more more wisely if they're paying more out of pocket. About 3 million people have opened health savings accounts. That's a small fraction of the insured. Jim Roosevelt is president and CEO of Tufts Health Plan. He was associate commissioner of Social Security in the Clinton administration and is active in Democratic Party politics here in Massachusetts. Welcome, Jim.
Glad to be with you.
We also welcome Charlie Baker, president and CEO of Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. He was Massachusetts Finance and Health and Human Services Director under two Republican governors. Charlie, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And can we talk more in depth about these health savings accounts first? Because many people have no clue what they are. Jim, can I start with you? We understand that they allow people to take their wages and put them in these savings accounts and have them be tax-free, and then they're expected to spend them on health care?
That is the basic idea of health savings accounts. They're an opportunity for people to take money, pre-tax dollars, and put it aside. Now, this often will be contributed by their employer, but put it aside to spend on health care or to save if they don't need to spend it during a given year.
That raises some of the questions. So is this money only to be spent on health care?
This money is only to be spent on health care. These are health savings accounts.
And does it roll over? In other words, if you get a certain amount, and we understand that they're capped, if you get a certain amount per year, if you don't use it, does it roll over into your savings account?
It does. You can carry it over from year to year.
And we understand that these health savings accounts are going to be offered to people who choose very low premium but very high deductible policies. Why is that, Jim?
These are required by the tax law to be coupled with a high deductible policy. And the reason for giving them a tax benefit is so that people will be more involved in making decisions on whether to spend money on health care. There's a feeling that if people have the traditional HMO, which is still very popular here in Massachusetts, that they think it only costs $5 or $10 to go to the doctor.
And if they have to pay for it out of their health savings account, they'll be more aware of what they're spending.
That's the theory behind health savings accounts.
Well, and that also brings us to some of the criticism that, for instance, Charlie Baker, if people see that it's going to cost more, yes, they may not spend frivolously, but they may not spend at all. And that leads us to more health problems down the line.
I think that's always been the struggle in healthcare, which is how do you come up with a model that creates the kinds of incentives for people to be smart about their healthcare spending so that they spend the right amount of money and not either too much or too little.
One way to deal with that that we've done when we started pioneering our Liberty Plan about 3 years ago is to couple a preventive care rider with the plan that the employer can add to the high deductible plan so that certain preventive care expenses are paid without going into the health savings account or being counted toward the deductible.
Such as?
Annual checkups, flu shots, so that people do the things they should be doing without stopping to think about, is this going to hurt what I can roll over in my savings account?
Well, and that brings up more criticism of health care. First, that insurers are too focused on providing expensive, catastrophic care for diseases like diabetes rather than less expensive preventive care. And second, that health savings accounts would attract healthy, wealthier workers, but that would erode the pooling that makes insurance affordable. Right now, the risk of health care costs is spread among the poor and the wealthy, the healthy and the unhealthy.
That's a real risk that we do have different risks in different types of insurance coverage, but there are ways to deal with that. It all depends on how the insurance plan backing the health savings account or linked with the health savings account is designed.
Hey, Charlie, you know, we just outlined some of the benefits, perhaps. You know, people may be not spending frivolously, some of the concerns about health savings plans. How do you feel about them?
Well, I'm sort of where Jim is, which is I think it's incumbent on health plans like ours to design plans that make sure that people continue to go for the annual physicals and the preventive care that that's so important to their overall health status. And many of the products that we've designed actually that involve deductibles wouldn't qualify under the current criteria for health savings accounts. Because they do cover a lot of those types of things, but they are, in fact, deductible plans. They do create incentives for people to think about how they spend discretionary money on healthcare services. And I think the real challenge for everybody going forward on this is how do you create a system or a set of plan designs that give people the right incentives to access care when they need it, but don't encourage them to overuse the system, which I think everybody would agree has been an historic problem as well.
Mm. You know, another aspect of the health savings plans, banks are very much behind them. In fact, there's a new lobbying arm behind them because people will have to, of course, open these savings accounts in banks. And some people wonder, you know, there's going to be a great deal of money in fees to be made through these accounts, often a $50 or $75 charge to set up a health savings account, $40 a year for maintenance. Do you worry about health plans becoming more involved in the banking business?
I worry more about banks becoming involved in the health plan business.
Well, yeah.
And I think any bank that thinks it knows how to run a health insurance company will be in for a few surprises, just as I think health insurance plans that think they can be banks may be surprised as well. And I think what we probably ought to both do is stick to our knitting and do what we do well.
Well, and as you know, the Bush administration is moving towards more market-driven and consumer-oriented healthcare. Is this just two insurance guys wanting to hold on to your turf, or do you really have concerns about that shift in responsibility for healthcare coverage from employers to individuals in the market?
Well, we've been doing consumer-directed health plans in three or four different flavors for several years, and we've discovered there's a lot to learn.
Charlie Baker, again, president and CEO of Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. If you would take off that hat for a moment and just tell us, as a consumer of healthcare, what's the one thing you would do to reform it?
The one thing I would do, I actually think one of the things President Bush talked about last night that everybody sort of glossed over is particularly important, which was the notion of establishing this bipartisan commission to take a look at Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. One of the biggest problems we have in healthcare these days is what is going to be the financing structure for Medicare and Medicaid going forward? And they represent, those two programs represent about 50% of all the spending that goes on in healthcare in the United States. We spend more, states spend more on Medicaid now than they spend on education. Mm-hmm. And I think unless the federal government figures out what the plan is for dealing with those two programs, it's going to be pretty hard for us to make a lot of progress on these issues generally.
The whole point of health savings accounts should be not to make people pay more that out of pocket, but rather to make people think about what they're paying for and to try to keep premiums down so that more people will be insured through their employer. President Bush did not step up to the bigger questions of how we deal with the uninsured, and state legislatures are making more progress on that than the federal government has been in recent years.
That's Jim Roosevelt, President and CEO of Tufts Health Plan, also Associate Commissioner of Social Security in the Clinton administration. Charlie Baker is President and CEO of Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. He was Massachusetts Finance and Health and Human Services Director under two Republican governors. Charlie and Jim, we thank you both.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And when we come back, how partisans on both sides of the aisle were unlikely to be swayed by anything said by either the president or the Democrats in their response last night because of how their brains are wired. And this note, last night, two people with very different views on the Iraq war were kicked out of the audience. Cindy Sheehan, who was an invited guest of Democratic Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, was handcuffed and removed for wearing a T-shirt that reportedly read, 2,245 dead, how many more? But Beverly Young, wife of Congressman Bill Young, a Republican from Florida, was also kicked out because she was wearing a T-shirt that said, supporting our troops, defending our freedom. According to the AP, a policeman told her they considered that statement a protest. She told him he was an idiot. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. The way they do. But first, readers here in Massachusetts picked up their Boston Globes today to read a stunning admission. Retired lawyer Robert Mandarosian says a former client stole $30 million worth of paintings, including a Cezanne, from a home collection in 1978, and that he, Mandarosian, has been holding on to them ever since. Well, not exactly holding on to them. He moved the paintings around the world, working with lawyers, to try to get a finder's fee from the original owner, Michael Blackwin, a plan that was thwarted by the Art Loss Register, a London-based company that tracks stolen art. The story broke when a London court yesterday identified Mandarosian as the man behind the plot to sell back the paintings. Amazingly, he's telling his story from the comfort of his Cape Cod home. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Let me ask you, first of all, Mr. Mandarosian, if I might, tell us how you came into possession of the pictures.
Well, I was representing a fellow named Colvin, who apparently was the one that took these paintings from a home. And interestingly, in that point, it wasn't a breaking and entering. He was given the key by someone in the family, as I recall. It's going back a long way when I, you know, questioned him about it. And he was told which room to go into and to take the paintings. Now, he was into drug business and apparently, you know, concluded that maybe somebody in the family owed him money and were going to pay him by giving him these paintings. But I was representing him on another case in the federal court, and he came to visit me from the western part of the state and came into my office to talk with me about the case we were going in on the next morning. And at the time he came in, he had this bag full of paintings, and he's telling me that he's got them and that they're going to be sold, and he's already sold them or fenced them in Florida. And I said to him, geez, you know, you got this case going here that we're involved in. If you do that, you know, you might get caught, and it's going to ball everything up, basically telling him, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. And then he didn't have a place to sleep that night, so I had another office in another building, and there was an attic in the building, and there was a little room up there. And so he went up there. Next day we went in, and we had our court thing. Now, several years, about a year later, I find the paintings. In the meantime, he'd been shot in a someplace in Massachusetts, maybe 6 months after I saw him.
And he's dead.
He's dead, okay. And then I go up into this attic because there was some pigeons and stuff up there, and I see this bag of paintings. Well, the first thought that comes to me is, you know, I can return these paintings and get a reward for it. That's very common, that's very normal, and there's no problem with that. But I find out that some of them were insured, and I had to find out who the insurance company was. And so it all took time, and I finally realized that there was only one or two of them insured, and the big one wasn't insured. So I decided that I would deal with the owner at some point. And I moved them out of the states.
Mr. Martirosian, let me interrupt here and ask you this question. I think a lot of people on the other end of the radio at this moment are asking themselves a very simple question. Why didn't you just return the paintings instead of trying to profit from it? I mean, these were stolen artworks.
Well, first of all, I didn't know who had ownership of them. That's number one. I didn't know who the owners of the paintings were. There was.
But you knew they were stolen. Your client told you that.
That's right.
So why didn't you go to the FBI and say, a client of mine stole these paintings, dropped them in my attic. I don't know who they belong to. You probably do. Here they are.
Well, I didn't do that because I didn't know who the owners were, and I wanted to get a reward for them. I mean, I wanted to turn them back in and go through this procedure which I had known about and get a reward from them. But I had to find out whether I'm going to be dealing with an insurance company or whether I'm going to be dealing with the original owners who may not have owned them at all. I had to find out who had title to them. And that's
I think a lot of people on the other end of the radio are going to be having a few moral questions about this. I mean, you know, if anyone in America receives stolen property, whether they know who it was stolen from or not, and then tries to get a reward for returning it, isn't that extortion?
No, I don't think it is. Well, look, that's the story. That's what it is. Those things could have been sold or fenced 100 times. My whole thought was I wanted to get them back to the original owner. That's
well, excuse me, but they were stolen.
All right, so look,
they were stolen in 1978. So this, you haven't exactly moved in a timely way to take care of this.
Well, look, this wasn't the only thing on my mind at the time. I had no idea what the real value of these things were.
Are you worried that you're going to be facing legal problems now?
It could be, sure. I could be.
Do you regret taking all this time?
But the main thing is that, you know, the $30 million painting, where did it go? Where did it end up? I take credit for that. Where did it end up? But for me, I can tell you this right now. You can talk all you want about, you know, what I should have done. And obviously, there are a lot of things I should have done that I didn't do. But if it were not for me, Bob Martirosian, Baekwin would not have had that particular painting back, and he would be out $30 million. They were on their way to Florida someplace, as I recall, and I stopped that. And later on, I said, I want to get him back to the owners. And, okay, was I wrong wanting to get a fee? Maybe I was. But, I mean, that's legal, and that's what people do, and that's what this ALR is all about. They want to deal with people once they determine that those people did not have anything to do with the original theft, which they determined I did not have anything to do with, or whoever they were dealing with had nothing to do with. And once they determine that, then they'll deal with you, take the art back, and give you a 10% fee.
Are you expecting a phone call from the FBI?
I don't know. Maybe. I'd be more than happy to talk with them. I have no problem with it.
Robert Martirosian, thank you very much.
Okay.
To be continued, that's retired lawyer Robert Martirosian speaking with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, former president of SDS and still lefty activist Todd Gitlin says the left needs to get over Vietnam and wave their flag a little more. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Applause and boos from his audience. There were lines that Republicans liked.
We need more than temporary tax relief. I urge the Congress to act responsibly and make the tax cuts permanent.
And those the Democrats approved of.
Congress did not act last year on my proposal to save Social Security.
Well, if a new study is to be believed, most of the people in the halls of Congress last night and those in living rooms around the country were listening and reacting emotionally to the president's speech, but not really thinking. Drew Weston is director of clinical psychology at Emory University in Atlanta. He's the author of a new study on the nature of partisan thinking, and he joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Thanks for being with us, Drew.
You're welcome.
And let's start with this fascinating study. You took 30 adult men who described themselves as very committed Republicans or Democrats, and you read them some statements by then-candidates Bush and Kerry and studied how their brains reacted. Now, first of all, can you set it up a little more? What were the statements that you read?
The statements for Bush might be something like the first slide comes up and what they read is a statement that says, and here I am in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Florida, and this is a place where doctors do their love. This is a great hospital, and I'm all for children's hospitals like this. The next slide then comes up and says something like, on the same day, the White House announced cuts of 20% to children's hospitals all over the country, including St. Elizabeth's.
Okay. That was the Bush template. What was the Kerry?
The first slide comes up, say, from 1996 that says that's Kerry being interviewed and saying, you know, we have to make tough choices about Social Security. We're going to have to consider everything, put everything on the table, means testing, changing the retirement age. You know, everything's got to be on the table to make this solvent. And then the next slide comes on and says, in a 2004 Meet the Press interview, we would never touch Social Security. Social Security is a sacred trust of their elders. I should add that these statements, most of them were true, but many of them were doctored slightly. And in a few cases, we took some creative liberties, but we made sure they sounded a lot like the candidate.
And how did the people in the study receiving these messages respond?
When there was a contradiction, the things that did react were the parts of the brain that were involved in emotion and emotion processing. What did not get increased activation, which was so striking, were the reasoning parts of the brain, the parts of the brain that have been shown in every study anyone's ever done to light up when people are actually thinking.
So people were just emotionally responding to their guy and not really thinking further about maybe he was contradictory.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing is they weren't consciously thinking. That was obvious. But by the end of that slide, they actually seemed to have come to some conclusions. And that was what was so interesting. And what the data were really suggesting was in this, when they're viewing this contradiction, they are probably unconsciously recruiting memories to try to make some sense of this thing that will make them feel emotionally comfortable.
Right. Well, can you relate this that you found to, let's say, last night's State of the Union? Does this mean to you that people who were listening to the speech were constantly, but maybe unconsciously, trying to rationalize everything if there was a contradiction?
I think that's fair to say that for about 75 to 80% of the electorate, there's virtually nothing that can get into their minds that's new when it has to do with things they feel strongly about politically.
I just know there are going to be listeners who are now rejecting this.
Yeah, and I can probably tell you what part of the brain's active while they're doing it, too.
And you say because they don't want to hear this thing that contrasts with how they view themselves. But what does this tell us about politics? Is it that people only hear what they want to hear, that a reasoned position paper doesn't stand a chance against, a negative ad that reinforces someone's belief system?
Well, you know, I think it really has two implications for campaigns. I mean, the first one is that, and these are frankly things that the Republicans understand very well and that the Democrats really don't understand at all.
Are you saying that at this particular time and place, even though you're saying that all partisans think this way, that perhaps one party has figured it out a little more?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Democrats and Republicans are playing on a very unlevel playing field because the Republicans understand how the mind works, and the Democrats are tenaciously holding on to an 18th century view of a dispassionate mind where people think things out, they reason things out, and that's how they make their voting decisions.
That's interesting because the criticism of Democrats in the past was that they were too much about feelings.
That the one Democrat who actually has been about feelings in the last 40 years is the only one who's won re-election. That's Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
The only other Democrat who has showed much feeling in the last few years was Howard Dean. But unfortunately, the feeling that he showed was anger, and that's not a feeling that tends to endear people to a politician.
Does this explain why, in this highly partisan, divided time, it's almost like cracking open an ice cube? If somebody actually changes their mind or disagrees with something they'd previously agreed with, I'm thinking, for instance, of, the war in Iraq.
Yes, it is. And it's something that tends to happen slowly. If you think about how it's taken 100 years since the association of the Republican Party with Lincoln for people in the South to turn Republican. I mean, it tells you how slowly those processes mostly happen. And for about 35% to 40% of the population, there really is nothing you can do to change their mind except over about 100 years.
What would you tell people to do with this information, Drew Weston? I mean, if partisans, and so many people are partisan now, are just sort of locked in and hearing only what they want to hear, and a part of their brain doesn't even activate to receive information and think about it rationally, what to do?
Well, I think there's really two or three things to do. As any kind of decision maker, whether you're a voter, whether you're a president, whether you're a senator, whether you're a CEO of a company, whatever your decision-making role is, if you find yourself coming to conclusions that fit with what you wanted to believe, and you know there's a group of people who are coming to conclusions listening to the same data that are different, you actually have to stop and override these brain mechanisms, because these are automatic brain mechanisms. You know, the kind of thing you can do for yourself is to stop and say, now, wait a minute. Let me now think about this if I were a Democrat or if I were a Republican on the other side. If I were a really smart one, well-meaning one, loyal one, patriotic one, what arguments would I be making? And let me take a look at those. Because what that would be to activate exactly the parts of the brain that are currently not getting activated.
You say it's automatic, but you can override it.
Absolutely. I think it's in many ways a design defect of the human brain. We are driven towards, emotionally driven towards ideas that make us feel comfortable. And that that happens automatically and unconsciously. And what we really have to do in cases like this is to fight that process.
Yeah. As you say, know that you want to believe something, but be honest with yourself.
Absolutely.
Wow, you spent a lot of money and did a study to tell people to be open-minded.
that's one way to put it.
Drew Weston, a researcher and psychologist at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, speaking to us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Oh, you bet.
And as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on our program. Any of your thoughts, we're open to them all. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or call our listener line. Leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the president made a brief reference to Hurricane Katrina in last night's State of the Union address. And today, congressional investigators released a report on the government's response to that storm. One sobering finding, the U.S. still isn't ready for a storm like Katrina. The Government Accountability Office also singled out Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff as failing to act as the central focal point during that storm. Meantime, the Senate Homeland Security Committee continues hearings today into Katrina. New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin testified today and said too much time was wasted trying to figure out who was in charge.
Being overwhelmed by a hurricane, there needed to be more resources that came much quicker and not necessarily a dance on, you know, whether state or federal authority rules. I mean, that's just ridiculous to me.
Well, joining us now with more, Spencer Hsu, Homeland Security Correspondent for The Washington Post. Spencer, today's hearings, we once again hear from Mayor Nagin basically saying what he said before, his city was abandoned. But you know, we've also heard it's more complicated than that. So how are the senators reacting?
Thanks, Robin. It's good to be with you. Senators are reacting with a mixture of sympathy and skepticism. The Republicans have pointedly asked, you know, rhetorically whether the city devoted enough resources to preparedness before Katrina, whether they had an effective command and control structure for the mayor, whether pre-landfall evacuation plans were made in time, and obviously, you know, the results sort of speak for themselves. Democrats are responding by saying, well, you know, didn't the mayor have called for those plans and called for federal help as much as 2 years before landfall? Their argument is that, you know, there's blame to go around and blame that comes back to Washington.
Well, in fact, in the Senate hearings yesterday, Louisiana state officials were in the hot seat. What came out of that?
Bipartisan Senate investigation that has been going on and will continue for another month spoke to the head of transportation of Louisiana, who told them, well, it's true that they didn't have a statewide coordinator in place, that they had done virtually nothing to implement its responsibility under an emergency plan endorsed by the state back in April that called for the Transportation Department to take the lead in evacuating at-risk populations. That would be the sick, the infirm, the elderly, the old. And, of course, those are precisely the people who accounted disproportionately for those killed by the storm.
Yeah, we understand that the state's top health official also said that he turned down help from Health and Human Services.
That's a little bit it's a little bit murky, but what is clear is that Senate investigators found emails from federal officials that said that, look, you know, we offered help on Saturday, 2 days before landfall, to the head state emergency health person, do you need anything? And they told us, no, we're fine. The response in the hearing from the state officials was that, well, we didn't ask because we didn't think the federal government could deliver.
Let's move to that General Accounting Office report just to ask that it said that neither Chertoff or any of his deputies in the disaster area acted as President Bush's overall storm coordinator. And that underscores for some a weakness in the way the government now responds to disasters. How big a blow is this to the Homeland Security Department? Because previously it had been Michael Brown of FEMA who was taking most of the heat.
I'm not sure how big a blow it is. I guess at first blush, it would be hard to underestimate the importance of this finding. The conclusion basically is that, you know, 2 years after the department was formed, 4 years after September 11th, in its first major test, the system failed. The administration from the top down failed to have an individual take charge. Now, exactly why that happened, you know, we may find out a little bit more in the near future. But the central finding is that whether it was the president or his chief of staff or his closest aides, the cabinet secretary in charge of the department, or his designee, Mike Brown, the FEMA official who was actually in Louisiana, no one clearly had the authority or executed the authority to bring together a response any quicker than what unfolded.
Well, Spencer Hsu, before we get you go, briefly, is there anything that immediately that might come out of these reports or investigations?
The one discouraging factor in this GAO report is that the Comptroller General, the head man for the Congressional Auditing Arm, said, well, you know, we've got 30 different reviews underway, and the House and the Senate are also reviewing. But the fact is that most of the recommendations after Hurricane Andrew back in 1992
were still not implemented. Spencer Hsu, Homeland Security Correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks so much for checking in with us.
Thank you for your time.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. called for stronger immigration enforcement and broader protection. But he also renewed his call for a guest worker program for illegal immigrants to work temporarily in the United States. This idea has caused division within the Republican Party between business owners who need the labor and those who believe in tougher enforcement laws. Well, behind the rhetoric and political division of immigration are the real lives of human beings. Throughout the years, writers have attempted to give a voice to those who've been voiceless. For example, Richard Vasquez's best-selling novel Chicano, which brought attention to the Mexican-American civil rights movement in the 1970s. Here now, literary critic Steve Almond has his own picks for books which illuminate the immigrant experience. He recently came in to tell us about them.
The first book I want to talk about is a new novel called The Saint of Lost Things by Christopher Castellani. And it's an astonishingly beautiful novel that is very much about what it was like to be an Italian immigrant in the 1950s in Wilmington, Delaware, of all places. And I want to read just a little scene in which two of our lead characters, Maddalena and Antonio Grasso. Antonio has brought Maddalena over from her little village in Italy, and they all live in a tiny little house with all their family, and they sneak away on Christmas Eve and go to on a little adventure to go to a car lot. And so I'll just read a little passage from that. "Mark my words," said Antonio, his palm flat on the hood of a coupe de ville. "I'll be driving one of these before I'm 40. He was 28, Maddalena 22. It was easy to imagine their lives in 9 years, gliding through the wallpapered rooms of their home in Newcastle, three kids at play in the yard, Sunday trips to A Street in the shiny Cadillac. They'd build up to this life, little by little, with double shifts and borrowed clothes and the fatty cut of meat. But when the life finally commenced, it would feel like a stroke of luck, like God appearing at the edge of the ditch to pull them up and out."
Ooh, Steve Almond reading from Christopher Castellani's book, The Saint of Lost Things. I have to say, I agree with you. I love this book.
Yeah, well, that is it. That is the immigrant dream. And I think what gets lost in the news coverage is that's what built this country, that energy, that striving, that desire to have the thing that will make life peaceful and contented through hard work, through sacrifice, the fatty cut of the meat.
Well, it's interesting because the book that you're quoting from is about the Italian immigrant experience, which has been romanticized. Other more recent modern-day immigrant experiences have been somewhat more controversial, and that's what the political debate now is, and I know you have another book.
Well, I want to talk about a nonfiction book called Women and Other Aliens. These are essays from the U.S.-Mexico border by an author named Debbie Nathan. She's a fairly prominent journalist and an absolutely beautiful writer. And she actually lived on the El Paso border, in El Paso, on the border with Juarez, for many years, and wrote a series of essays in this book that is all about the day-to-day reality of being both on the American side and on the Mexican side. I want to read a little bit from an essay called The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You. It's about what it would be like to be constantly judged and potentially deported if you have the wrong look, if you're from Mexico and you have the wrong look. "But today, intimate little fajita cookouts are awkwardly framed against a backdrop of miles of cardboard and adobe shacks lying across the Rio Grande just a few blocks away. It's not uncommon at such parties for the hostess to answer a knock at the door and find an unequivocally polite young man asking in Spanish if she needs her yard done as he stares unequivocally starving at the barbecue grill. The only unknown about such encounters is whether the young man is legal or illegal. How can you tell? That question defines the nitty-gritty basics of the look. Indeed, the true clothes horses of the border are mojados, the people who wet their own toes if they're horribly poor, or other people's if they're just terribly poor, to cross the Rio Grande. They know that to keep your $40 a week job without being deported, to escape to Chicago and get paid almost like a real American human, they must learn that certain weaves of sombreros practically scream alien. Better to wear a baseball cap, but be sure the decal on it is a credible trucker motif. What about those boots? Are the edges of the heels cut exactly perpendicular to the ground, like they make them in Texas? Because if they're sliced on a slant, the wearer is from Chihuahua, or worse, even further south. And how about that shiny black shirt with the purple zigzags? Take it off. Here's a t-shirt that says UCLA. Much better. That's the look. Not very exciting, you say? But you're not the judge. The final arbiter of fashion here is the Border Patrol, some 520 men and women in uniform who cruise about the El Paso area in bile green squad cars and Ram Charger vans with bars on the windows, checking out everyone on the streets, determining who has the good taste to be allowed to live and work here in peace, and who shall be spun through the endlessly revolving door of deportation, illegal reentry, deportation that keeps workers trapped in the sub-minimum wage and sub-minimum life sector of the U.S. economy.
Steve Almond, again, reading from Women and Other Aliens, a collection of essays from the U.S.-Mexico border by Debbie Nathan. The fashion of immigration.
Oh, yeah. And it's not just what you wear, but there's also a term in Spanish meaning that you've been eating enough protein. And that look is very important. You know, having lived in El Paso, there's a certain sallow pallor that you have if you literally are not getting enough protein. And so it's very important when you're going to be heading over the border, especially if you're going to try going further up north into America, that you have plenty of protein, you know, for the week before, so you've really got the right look. It's an entire – what I love about these essays is it really puts people in the psychological and emotional place of the immigrant.
What's the word, by the way, the Mexican word about for the
– it's called proteinazado. To have I'm probably mangling the pronunciation, but you know, and it's one of the things that Debbie Nathan talks about, and I hadn't thought about it even living in El Paso, that there's a very particular look. And in the essay, which is actually quite funny in spots, she talks about counseling this young woman and saying, no, that's not the look, you know. And they talk to one another, the folks who are heading over from Juarez, and you know, trying to figure out. And I'm absolutely certain, even though this essay was written, you know, more than a decade ago, the same thing is going on.
Okay, so two books that Steve's read from for us. And Steve, I know before you go, you've got two others that you highly recommend.
Sure. The novel Vida by Melania Mazzucco. She's an Italian novelist, actually. This is her fourth novel, and it's getting absolutely amazing reviews. It is the immigrant saga, the Italian immigrant saga, dating back, you know, to the, not the turn of the century, but the 10s and 20s. And it's really about living in Little Italy in New York, the big city. And it's both a fictional account of a couple of characters who fall in love and for various reasons can't get together, beautifully written. But it also has little sections of nonfiction that are the author's actual research that she's done into her family's own immigrant past. And I also wanted to recommend one of the greatest books that's ever been written about the immigrant experience, which is the novel Call It Sleep by Henry Roth. And again, it's about the Lower East Side, the Yiddish-speaking immigrants who came over in the Lower East Side. And you're absolutely submerged in the mind of a six-year-old kid who is going through the experience, because they're the ones who experience it most purely, because they've got one culture at home speaking a particular language, and then they're contending with the new American culture outside the home. So it's a very beautiful book.
Here now, literary critic Steve Almond teaches creative writing, by the way, at Boston College and helps us out here as well. Steve, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
For a complete list of Steve's picks, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.